In Studio A, David Berkley and band.
There's a fire in my head tonight. There's a fire in my head. Well, you went to the desert, walk across the valley. You went looking for something, find who you could be. Yeah, when you went away, everything changed. Now I'm out here in the fields, praying for rain. So I went up to the rooftop, I went down to the alley. I was looking for something, find who I could be. Yeah, once I looked, I couldn't look away. Now I'm out here in the streets, praying for rain. 'Cause there's a fire in my head tonight. There's a fire in my head. No, there's no rain tonight. No rain inside tonight. There's no rain tonight. There's no rain. There's no rain. There's no rain. Going crazy, I'm wondering how they know when I'm tearing out the pages once again. I'm out under the stars praying for rain. 'Cause there's a fire in my head tonight. There's a fire in my
I'm David Berkley, and I'm here from Santa Fe with my Santa Fe band of champions. This is Josh Martin on the bass guitar, Paul Federici on a little snare drum set up here, and Mr. Ben Wright on the electric guitar. And we're really happy to be here, be back at KUNM. That was The Fire in My Head, which is the title track from our last record. But we're mostly here to present our new project, which is a new record and a new book. And the album is called Cardboard Boat. And the book is called The Free Brontosaurus. And the way it works is the book is 10 stories that weave together, and each song on the record is from the perspective of a main character in each story. So what I thought we would do with our time here is to give you a taste of the project. So I'm going to actually read a little bit from one of the stories, and then we're going to play that song that comes out of that story, and we'll do that a couple times. And this is a story that's called The Find, and it's going to set up the song Dinosaurs and Sages. When Russell had first laid eyes on the dinosaur earlier that day, however, its lack of knees was just a minor curiosity, certainly not cause for alarm. Russell was so attracted to the odd creature, so mystified by his appearance, that details hardly mattered. Russell was in an altered state. feeling like an archaeologist who had stumbled upon some lost city. In fact, he was so mesmerized he didn't even notice the sign at first. But after the shock of the discovery faded slightly, there it was, clear as day. An index card rested against the dinosaur's front left leg with four large black capital letters. Russell read the letters individually. F-R-E-E. Then he sounded the word out like a child learning to read. Free. He bent down to get a closer look. He read it again. Free. Russell looked up from the card and removed his glasses. He looked up and down both sides of the block. He squinted up at the windows of that yellow house. Then he put his frames back on, looked down again at the card. Now what in the world could that mean? Free could be interpreted in any number of ways, of course, so Russell had to be cautious, had to think them all through. Understandably, he first read the sign as a proclamation of the wildness of the noble beast, his manifest destiny, his limitless domain. His was a time long before man, before fences, before sidewalks, before suburbs, before laws, before social pressures, before judgment of any kind. His was a time before the fall. No one was going to tell this god of the swamps how to behave. No, sir. He was free to do whatever the heck he damn well pleased. Free to roam, free to run anywhere, free from responsibility, free from all the shackles of society. You bet he's free, Russell announced. You betcha. Russell put his hat back on and started to walk away. But the more he thought about it, the less comfortable he felt with his interpretation. Russell came to believe it was an odd read. After all, the creature was made of stone and was only about 2 feet tall by 4 feet long, and that counted the tail. Then there was the kneeless situation to consider. So Russell stopped and turned back around, trying hard to imagine how any other definition of free might apply. It stumped him. He had just about decided to give up when his eyes opened wide in wonder, in disbelief. Free? A few moments passed. Russell didn't move a muscle. Could it really be that simple? Would someone possibly just give this guy away? But why? It didn't make any sense. They didn't want anything in exchange, not money, not a different animal, nothing? Russell mouthed the word free a few more times, getting increasingly excited. He looked up and down the block once more. He tried again to see past the knickknacks on the windowsill to see if someone were watching, someone he could ask. He looked at the sky for a sign. He saw nothing, no one. He looked back down at the card. Then Russell grinned broadly, shrugged his shoulders, bent at his knees, noting their importance as he did. And then, with a loud grunt, he hoisted the brontosaurus up and into his arms. Well, he nearly threw the damn thing up and over his shoulder. The dinosaur was so light, lighter by a long shot than Russell had estimated. What had looked so much to him like chiseled stone was just styrofoam. Couldn't have weighed more than a pound or two, but no matter. He had it now, and he hugged his creature to his chest. Russell felt something then he hadn't felt in years, 22 years to be exact, since he'd last seen Lucy, since he'd felt her skin against his. And when he put his arms around the belly of this brontosaurus, he had to work hard to fight back tears. "Criminy," he whispered, taking off his glasses and wiping his eyes with his fur cap. "I think he's mine." And for the first time in a long, long while, Russell counted himself among the lucky ones.
I've been looking so long, wasn't sure for what. I was wondering what's wrong, always wrong side up. You can see me on the corner, see me in the road, feeling like a foreigner, cannot crack the code. Oh, to go back to the start, but then I saw part of you that no one else has seen, and I saw the heart of you and all that you could be, and I know you can go anytime you want to, but I hope you will stay. Here's one for the ages, some say all along.
ages. No one seems to stay for long. I tried to go back to the start, but then I saw part of you. No one else has seen, and I saw the heart.
Called Dinosaurs and Sages. We're going to do another one from the new record now. I'm not going to read you the story, though. We'll get back to the readings shortly. This is a song called The Last Round. And any of the songs on the record that pair with female characters, and this one is one of those, I was fortunate enough to get the great Sarah Watkins of Nickel Creek to sing the high harmony parts. So she sort of embodies the female characters in the book. And there aren't many women who sing like her nowadays. This is a revenge song. It's one of the only songs on the record that has a little bit of anger in it. And it also has a chorus that's a little bit like a yodel. So if you're the yodeling type and you're listening in your vehicle or in the shower and you'd like to try to sing along, go for it.
Of you again, I've been falling apart. I guess maybe the earth must break to shake you from my heart. Come back to block out the sun. So
good singing out there. Again, if you're just joining us, I'm David Berkeley, and I'm really, really happy to be playing with these amazing musicians. We're all from Santa Fe. This is Josh Martin playing the bass, and Paul Federici on a snare drum, and a tambourine on chair, and Ben Wright on the electric guitar. Moving back to the book combo, I'm going to read you a little excerpt from another story now. And again, the way this works is the stories, they all weave together, so the characters meet in each other's stories, and then each song on the record is one of the characters' songs. So this is going to be George's song, and you're about to hear a little bit about George and his obsession with bridges. All these characters are sort of misfits in one way or another. They find beauty in strange places, they get obsessed with different things than you or I might get obsessed about. And that alienates them, and they're lonely a lot of the time, but ultimately they find each other, and they find connection, and that redeems them and offers them hope. After Julie left, George took 2 weeks vacation from the bank. He couldn't muster up the energy to count money, to smile at people. Everything became hard for him, small tasks, taking out the trash, running errands, even brushing his teeth, drying off after a shower, shaving. He hated seeing himself in the mirror. His hair went from salt and pepper to just salt. The bags beneath his eyes became purple and pronounced. He'd only just turned 58, but George seemed to look older and older each day. One morning, a friend dragged him out to take a walk down by the marina. George spotted a huge piece of equipment floating on a barge under the bridge. "The hell is that for?" he asked. Neither had a clue what it was. "That old thing," the friend said when they were back on the bus and George was still talking about it. "Must be something for the bridge." "Gonna take more than some piece of crap on a barge," his friend barked, "if they ever want to finish it." George hadn't argued at the time, but his curiosity was piqued. He went back the next day to take a closer look. Turned out the barge was hauling a massive hydraulic pile hammer, and indeed it was for the bridge. That pile hammer, he soon learned, was about to drive a piece of reinforced steel deep into the bedrock almost 300 feet below the surface of the water. It would ultimately help all the other piles hold up that big bridge. George couldn't fathom the strength required to drive that pile way down into the crust of the earth, let alone to hold up a bridge. Lately, he'd hardly been able to hold himself up. George kept heading back there. He went after his shifts ended or on his days off. At first, it was maybe once or twice a week, and only for a couple of hours, but he started staying longer and longer. He took sick days. Soon it became the only thing George looked forward to. Eventually, summer came and George quit his job. It was the boldest decision he'd made in recent memory. He had enough in savings to live for a while. He began going to the water every day. He found a spot on the pier that offered the best view. He became obsessed with what was happening. He even began to anticipate what the crew would work on the following day. George appreciated the beauty and quiet grace of the design, the simplicity of the single pentagonal tower, the subtle arc of the main cables, the gentle curve of the deck. It was crisp and clean and somehow feminine, but it was strong, sturdy, and reliable, more reliable than anything else in his world. George read everything he could about bridges. He went to the library, took out book after book. He learned about the particular challenges of this bridge, like the structural requirements, and how the bearings and shear keys had to allow the span to give and move in an earthquake. He read about the load on the main cables, an almost unimaginable burden they had to bear. He became an expert on the different booms on the various cranes, and he was there, of course, when one of those cranes tipped over and crashed into the water. George felt that accident personally and powerfully. If George tried to explain what it was he saw on that bridge, why he was watching it, people would quickly lose interest. It wasn't something easily understood, certainly not easily articulated. The building of that bridge simultaneously calmed and excited him. It represented the best in mankind. Real water was out there to be crossed. That's what George wanted to say. Even if the engineers used new computer models and simulations, that span made of real steel was the only way to cross it. Real workers were out there building it. They existed in the real world. They used real tools, held them in their real hands. They spread out real blueprints. It took real time.
Have you heard that there's water some would die to find? in a well in some forest can turn more than to wine. No, not sure I believe it. I'm not sure that I do. But lately I have been grasping for something to pull me through. Where's the wishing well? Where's the wishing well? And I feel like a traveling salesman going door to door. Though I don't like to say it, sometimes I want it more. All my life for my lady, 20 years is one. Then one morning she wakes up, George, she says we're done. Where's the wishing well? Where's the wishing well? Where's the wishing well? Where's the wishing well? And now I'm left building bridges, if only in my mind, trying hard to cross chasms, trying to turn back time. All my days I was spinning other people's dreams. All my nights I was sitting, wondering what it means. Where's the wishing well? Where's the wishing well? Where's the wishing well? Where's the wishing well? Where I'd start. Build me a bridge that's forever between two heads and hearts. Where's the wishing well? Where's the wishing well? Is there a wishing well? Where's the wishing well? If there's a wishing well, be my wishing well.
Going to do a song actually from the last record again, and then we'll come back and do one more from the final project and read into the little excerpt again. This is the first song on our last record, The Fire in My Head. The song is called Back to Blue.
There's a rising moon somewhere, autumn leaves are everywhere. Could that have been a smile? Yes, I know it's been a while. Sometimes we're lost out in the wild. I've been looking up and down. But do you hear that far off sound? Like the birds were circling round, like the breeze was whispering. Oh, good things one day begin. If I knew the words I'd sing loud so you could hear. But we have only this one chance. Let's take it, my dear. Let's taste it, my dear. And some arrows miss the mark. Sometimes the match won't spark. That's not how the story ends. No, that can't slow us down, my friend. Do the best we can to mend. Stop the fighting, calm the fear. 'Cause we have only this one chance. Let's take it, my dear. Let's taste it, my dear. We have only this one chance. Let's take it, my dear. Let's taste it, my dear. Don't let me waste it,
Well, thanks again, Matthew, for having us. Again, I'm David Berkley, and Josh Martin on the bass, Paul Federici on the drum, singular, and Ben Wright on the guitar. And we're going to close our mini set with a song called To the Sea, and I'm going to read a little excerpt from the story that goes with it from the book The Free Brontosaurus. When the knock came, Russell didn't answer. He couldn't possibly have imagined the banging was for him. He jumped a little when it continued, finally recognizing the knuckles making the noise were actually rapping on his door. "Criminy, that's my door," he said. "Ah, the ferns," he added, certain that the former tenants finally had come back for their plants. It had been almost a dozen years since the two guys had moved out, yet Russell still assumed it was one or both of them out there knocking. "Out here," he hollered, getting up from the couch and starting toward the balcony. "They're out here, doing great, just a sec." But the voice that came back didn't sound like a former tenant's voice. No. The voice that came back wasn't what Russell had expected at all. It was a female's voice, a little shaky, it was quiet, it was sweet, and it made no mention of potted plants. "Russell?" That was what the lovely, shy voice said. "Russell." He froze at the sound. Who could possibly know my name? "Russell!" There it was again. Now what in the heck could this lady want? Well, when he heard what she said next, Russell fell right back onto the couch. Hit the cushions hard. Felt like he fell right through the floor into the very earth below. His face went crimson. His eyes bulged. He looked up at the ceiling. Russell didn't believe in God, but he prayed to that ceiling for strength, for anything. "Russell, it's Lucy." He hadn't heard that name in 20 years. It didn't make sense. He didn't understand. He tried to stop it from registering. He gripped the ripped cushions beneath him. He didn't breathe a word. Lucy knocked again. "Russell, please, can you just open up?" The longer the door stayed shut, the harder Lucy found it to remain out there.
What had she been thinking coming unannounced? It wasn't fair. She hadn't seen him in more than 2 decades. She didn't know if he'd even want to see her. She turned her back to the door, but she did not leave. Staring at the dirty hallway carpet, she called again for Russell to at least come out into the hall. Russell heard every word, could hear her breathing, but he did not respond. He couldn't respond. He was listening intensely. He was trying desperately to grasp the situation, trying to make sense of it, to put it into a box, to decide what he should do. Must be a lot of people named Lucy, he ultimately reasoned. This doesn't have to be the Lucy. Can't be the Lucy. Far more people out there named Lucy who aren't my Lucy than the single Lucy who is. Russell worked madly to develop a theory that made sense of it all. But even if the brain was willing, the heart wasn't. He couldn't hold back the truth. Lucy was less than 15 feet from him after 20 years, and who knew how many miles, only a few sheets of laminated plywood suddenly stood between them. I hear you in there. Come on, it's okay. Open up. Russell eyed the fire escape, thought about making a break for it, but he couldn't move. He was completely paralyzed. He put his hands to his neck and temples. They were on fire. He hadn't felt temples that hot since the bout of dengue fever he'd gotten in Mexico, and that had almost killed him. Criminy, he whispered. Lucy was still knocking. Come on, Russell. Not the best time, he finally said, his voice cracking. I'm burning up in here. She didn't know what that meant. Please, she said again. I don't have anywhere else to go. At that, he broke. He gave in. He threw his head back. He pushed himself up from the couch. He walked anxiously to the door, put his palm against the doorpost. Christ, is it really you, Lucy?
Father, 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 I am coming home. Open up the gates, please let me in. Everybody needs some way to start again. Oh, I've been on a road not always kind. Yes, it's been a long, hard climb. So Father, 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 lay your hand in mine. Sometimes all we carry holds us down. But letting go is hard, I've found. So let me be like the leaves on the trees. They come back in the spring. Go to green. Oh, let me be like the stream full of rain. It comes back eventually to the sea. It comes back eventually to the sea. Tell me, will we ever reach the promised land? There's nothing we can do to change the past. Will we ever get to say we're free at last? Oh, don't you know the war's over and done? I'm pretty sure more lost than won. So let me be. They come back in the spring, go to green. Or let it be like the stream full of rain. It comes back eventually to the sea. Thank you. needs a place to lean. Yeah, you and me both, it seems. So let me be like the leaves on the trees. They come back in the spring, go to green. Or let be like the stream full of rain. It comes back eventually.
Recorded live, very live, in Studio A by Ethan Stein. David Berkley Band are David Berkley vocals, readings, acoustic guitar, Ben Wright, electric guitar and harmony vocals, Josh Martin, bass and harmony vocals, Paul Federici, drums and percussion.